Hello, everybody, and welcome to the e-learning lounge, where we'll be exploring how technology is reshaping education and training worldwide. I'm your host, Josh Sternlicht.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very first episode of the e-learning lounge brought to you by Piedmont Global Language Solutions, or PGLS. I'm your host, Josh Sternlicht, and I'm thrilled to have you join me as we kick off this exciting journey into the ever-evolving world of e-learning. My concept of the e-learning lounge is I want it to be a space where we'll explore the latest trends, tools, and technologies that are shaping the future of learning and development. Everything from the impact of AI on education to authoring tools, adaptive learning, and instructional design strategies. We'll cover a wide range of topics that are crucial for anyone interested in how learning happens today, whether you're an educator, a corporate trainer, a tech enthusiast, or simply curious about the future of education. I want there to be something here for everyone. That's my hope. That's my goal. So, all right. With that said, today, I am incredibly excited to introduce our very first guest, Professor David Rubenstein. David is a distinguished law professor at Washburn University in Kansas, holding the James R. Ahrens Chair in Constitutional Law. He serves as director of the Robert J. Dole Center for Law and Government. Prior to teaching, and this is pretty cool, Professor Rubenstein clerked for the Honorable Sonia Sotomayor when she was a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and for the Honorable Barbara Jones in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. He also served as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York and as an associate in King and Spalding's New York office. David's expertise spans constitutional law, administrative law, and the legal challenges surrounding artificial intelligence. What I think makes David's perspective valuable today is his deep understanding of how AI and emerging technologies intersect with education and e-learning. He's not only a leading voice on ethical AI governance, but also offers unique insights into how these technologies are transforming the way we approach education and learning environments. His legal scholarship is widely cited in law journals and in several judicial opinions. But more importantly, beyond all of his professional accomplishments, I am extremely proud to call David a very, very, very close friend. I've known him now for over 30 years. So without further ado, David, welcome to the e-learning lounge. It is an honor to have you here as my first guest. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Josh. This is wonderful. And I'm really looking forward to having a discussion with you about all the things you just talked about.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Now, I know you've been really busy. And I appreciate you taking the time that we've had some schedule conflicts. I'm so glad we got this going. You are working on an article right now. I hope that's okay. I don't know what the article is about. You're always writing about interesting things, and I love hearing about it. Can you discuss what you're working on and what this article is about?
Yes, I'd be really happy to. Thanks for asking.
Okay.
The article is titled Federalism and Algorithms. And let me explain what I mean by that, and we'll break that down because some of the elements of that will certainly tie into our discussion later. You'll remember probably, Josh, from fifth grade and maybe again in your senior year of high school about how you learned about how government works. And the way that our constitutional system is structured, we have checks and balances. We have the three branches of government, the courts, the legislature, the executive branch. And so it's often referred to as the separation of powers when we talk about all of those federal branches of government. But the other dimension of our constitutional architecture is federalism. And so that's also a term that people have certainly heard about. But in addition to separating power between the three branches of government, the Constitution also separates power between the federal government writ large and all of the states. And so that's federalism. It's the relationship between the federal government and the states. Okay, so you have it's a very complex set of actors interacting to create laws and policy for the country. That's federalism.
Got you. Now,
But let me say this quickly. The algorithms is just a reference to artificial intelligence. And that too is obviously a very complex term that is defined many different ways. For the most part, our discussion today will probably be focused on the latest wave of artificial intelligence, generative AI, which is simply one category of all the different types of artificial intelligence algorithms that exist and have existed for decades. But all of the hype, all of the attention that AI has received over the last 2 years was really sparked by the release of ChatGPT at the end of 2022 and all of its offspring, like all the video editing now and the audio and the images and so on and so forth. So this article is really about the intersection of those two very complex worlds, and it'll be the first when it comes out, a really deep study into those issues.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah, because I remember with AI, you started talking about this with me like I think 3, 4 years ago. And I know you've done like a lot of work on AI and governance. And first of all, particularly I have that, your emphasis was on ethical AI procurement. Can you talk about, first of all, what that even means, ethical AI procurement? And I'm just curious, like, and not to go off the rails, but I know you were very heavily involved with like immigration law for a long time, and then you kind of made this pivot. So I'm kind of curious on how you got to focus on this intersection of AI and law.
Yes, I'd say the immigration was something that I became an expert in when I was working for the U.S. Attorney's Office as a practitioner before I went into teaching. And then as a law professor, I started out teaching immigration, among other things, and wrote several articles in the area of immigration. But I've went a separate way. I mean, I still have immigration on my radar. It's a very important issue. But immigration is not what took me or led me to the world of artificial intelligence. I also, as you mentioned, I teach constitutional law. I teach administrative law, which involves all of the alphabet agencies, the SEC, FTC, FCC, Department of Education. And so that is really where my expertise has sort of transitioned to. And the reason I started getting interested in artificial intelligence, which will then sort of dovetail into your question about procurement and things like that, is that the government, beginning around, I don't know, 2019 or so, really started looking into the opportunities as well as some of the challenges of integrating artificial intelligence into governments, so that the government itself is using artificial intelligence, let's say, to adjudicate applications for benefits or to investigate or to find patterns in the data that might point to fraudulent transactions in the market, things like that, or the IRS. And certainly facial recognition at the time and still today used by the FBI and other kinds of law enforcement agencies and DHS, right? So that's what got me interested in artificial intelligence because I saw that, hey, this is like it's really a very undeveloped area of governance at the federal level and parallels at the state levels and local levels as well. And I just kept thinking, gosh, this looks like it's going to be big. And now's the time to get involved. And so I started my journey and been about 2019, 2020. And when ChatGPT hit at the end of 22, I was already on that learning curve, which, by the way, has not ended and not stopped. And I'll never be at the top of it because there's just more and more to learn because the field is expanding and growing so quickly that it's just keeping up. It's never going to be, oh, I'm on top of everything. And so I hit the ground running when ChatGPT landed. And other people, I wasn't certainly not the only one, but it's a very small group of people. Now that group is growing. And anyway, so it's a very interesting time. Now, about procurement, this is it will get us sort of into the link between the government and the private market, the vendors, including firms like your own, is that AI, certainly the modern machine learning versions, are virtually unregulated, right? And the federal government, despite its many pockets of excellence, right, they certainly have experts at artificial intelligence within government. But that expertise and also the resources, the capital that the federal government has invested in building institutions that understand this technology pales in comparison to the private market. And so when the federal government says, hey, we'd like to get AI into our agencies, we want to use these for back office, even things like HR stuff, like internal facing, but also things like enforcement and, things like that that we talked about, where's the federal government getting AI from? Well, it's buying it from the industry. And so then you get this really, I'll say interesting, but to me, concerning dynamic, where the federal government is essentially procuring or buying unregulated technology from the private market. That is concerning because it's not like buying a tank or buying an airplane or buying cars or buying pencils and staplers, buying any or even buying like services like prison administration. They're buying things that the government itself doesn't really understand and that isn't regulated. And then the government's going to turn around and use it. And so this is what got me interested. I'm like, this is a big deal. And so that was my first article.
Got it. Okay, so they're getting this information from what's the entities? They're like
Not not
AI
not
companies.
yes, not the not just the information, although that's part of it, the products, Josh. Like if the, like the, let, let's say an e-learning platform or algorithms that are used or AI systems that are developed for particular purposes, the government is basically procuring that software and the service, usually not just the algorithm, but just with third-party vendors from the private market,
Got it.
who are, by the way, again, who are not regulated. So that's where the governance come in, right? Like the we are really 2018, 2019 is there's a lot of talk about ethical AI, which is also now called responsible AI or trustworthy AI. And like that's something maybe we'll get into, but just the language, the choices of words that people use to attach to whatever they're trying to sell or pitch, often there's a reason for it. And so it's just interesting to follow the language. So ethical AI, responsible AI, trustworthy AI, for now, I think it's safe to assume they're really all the same thing. They're just packaged differently, just for rhetorical reasons, mostly. But because the government itself, again, doesn't fully understand the technology, certainly not 3 or 4 years ago, they're much further along today after the release of ChatGPT and all the investment that the government has put into learning more about this. And also, but because the technology is not regulated, that's where these like self-regulation, governance, again, the word governance is another example. That's not government, it's governance. Then they talk about soft law. That's not binding law, or they'll talk about self-regulation. That's not government regulation. They'll talk about democratizing technology or democratizing AI. That's not democracy. And so it's just like all of those are just good examples of what I was saying before, is that terminology can, there's usually a lot packed into that. And so ethical AI, responsible AI is really a way to ensure that when the government buys the stuff from the private market, at least the government can insist by contract, if not by law, that when it selects vendors from whom they're going to procure this technology, that the vendors are taking care to make sure that the technology is safe, non-biased, right? That cybersecurity and privacy protections are sufficiently in place. And the idea behind my article was that you could create a competitive marketplace through the government, which is the largest purchaser in the world, right? So the market power comes enables a type of influence that is soft law, like because nobody has to contract with the government, but for any company that wants to, they'll be competing, at least this was the hope, around taking initiatives, best practices to ensure that their AI systems are safe, secure, things like that.
What so my you kind of answered this question, but I was going to ask you, what do you think are the right ethical guidelines and regulations to ensure AI benefits education and society, not just businesses? And I think you started to mention that, well, it's those vendors of AI that need to kind of, I guess, what did you like, kind of guard themselves, but if there's no regulation, how can we enforce that?
Well, this is the thing, right? I mean, let me just say that the reason why there is a positive case, obviously, for a government light touch or soft law or for self-regulation. Number one, government regulation could be burdensome, it could be unnecessary, it can prohibit or create barriers for new market entrants, small businesses, right? And so there are good reasons why the government may not want to regulate AI, or if it does regulate AI, to sort of do it prudently so as not to quash innovation, not to stifle what many think is maybe the most important technology in decades, if not, some people say, civilization. So the you ask me, what can, what's the relationship between binding regulation and what can vendors do? I mean, you and obviously the industry is in a better position to know what are the market forces? Where are the incentives? There's a famous sort of saying like, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcomes. And if the incentives are to win business, and it's to make profit, as they often are, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, and often it's a duty to the shareholders to but if the incentives are to create capabilities to make the best products that could do the most things, that could overshadow any efforts because resources and time are limited to put into safety. And to make sure that the systems don't fail, to make sure that they are not biased. And so, when it comes to things like, especially for online education platforms, this was certainly came up during the COVID era, where there's lots of like online proctoring, there's lots of online learning. And in the legal field, we had bar exams online. And facial recognition is, one way that many companies were proctoring. You'd log on and take an exam, and the camera would be looking at you, and it'd be looking at your facial expression. That you're looking up, are you looking to the side? Are you cheating? And if you're logging in to take the bar exam, then you got to show an ID, and then with facial recognition, is it the person? Well, because these AI systems just historically just don't work as well in identifying people with darker skin tones, people of color, especially women of color, and we can explain why that's the case, but it was certainly in 2020, it was definitely the case. It's gotten a little better, if not considerably better. But people were trying to log into exams, like really high-stake exams, like take your bar after, and the system would not recognize them. And you'd call customer service and like the bar exam is starting and you can't log on. And they say, shine a flashlight on your face. That's how, if you're a person of color and the AI system cannot recognize you, the solution is to shine a flashlight on your face. And that is obviously, can you imagine just the dignity, the dignitary harm in something like that, plus the anxiety. And what if you don't get on and you lose time, So this is the kind of ways that bias just one way that bias could actually have consequences, not just dignitary, but really create kind of anxiety going into an exam that is going to determine whether or not you could be a lawyer, for example. But this is not just in the law, this is happening all over the place. And so I just happen to know about that example because I'm so close to it.
Well, since you, that's great. And since you're touching on bias, you've introduced me to that, to the book Co-Intelligence by Ethan Mollick. And let's talk about bias, because this is something that I was trying to wrap my head around, and it's kind of, I don't know if I have it right, but he talks about something called reinforcement learning from human feedback. So, which, and please explain this if I'm doing it not so well, but it's like the AI, you have human beings that are interacting with AI. And so when the AI spews out like an answer, maybe if it's more biased or if it's completely wrong or it's dangerous, the human will correct it, and it will try to give a more of an unbiased opinion, or correct it if something came out wrong. Reinforcement learning from human feedback. But then I was thinking, like, but then again, like the bias, the human being might come into that equation and answer the AI with its own, maybe it doesn't mean to, but it has its own bias, and its answers will create even more bias. So it's like this perpetuating cycle where, like, you're trying to fix bias, but biases is keep going because of the human feedback. And it just seems very complicated. Where can you get a correct outcome?
There's a lot. First of all, you're right. That is, you have your finger directly on it. You understand it extremely well. I want to just add a little bit of context to that. I want to zoom out. I want to expand, and then zoom back in once it's in context. Let me just take a minute to explain the difference between traditional software and modern AI systems. So traditional software, think about just coding line by line by line by line, giving instructions like if this, then that, if that and this, then this. So this is, good old-fashioned AI or even just your general software programs, think of, PowerPoint, Word, is that a human has to code every single action that will tell the system what to do next. And one little bug, I don't know if you ever try to code something, it just won't work. It'll just get hung up. Like it just can't proceed further. Right. So that's what AI was, right, for a long time. But it turns out that there are things that just cannot be explained. Like with we have common sense and situational awareness that we take so many things in our environment for granted. I mean, how would you describe line by line how to do a backflip? How to do a left-hand turn at 3 p.m. in driving on the road? Certain things. So one way to, and it's interesting because it really actually ties into to education. If you think about what are the ways that we educate, even if it's our kids, our students, as adults training. One very important way to educate is through telling. You tell people this is what, the facts are, this is what the history is, whatever. You tell people. And that's equivalent to sort of good old-fashioned AI, where a human would have to type in every line of code. You're telling the computer what to do, what to think, what to do next. But the other way that we learn is through doing. Like through experiencing, not just being told. And so the equivalent there is, this is where you get into so-called machine learning, is that now what computers were able to begin doing at scale, beginning around, 2012 was a big breakout year, is that the new modern AI systems are called machine learning because they're learning from data. In other words, you give the system a lot of data, a lot of examples. You want to have a system that could distinguish between cats and dogs, then give it a million pictures of cats and dogs, and you give the computer the answer, and you say, look, these 500,000 are cats, these 500,000 are dogs, right? And by the way, humans are labeling those pictures cats and dogs, okay? You give it to the computer and you say, you figure it out. You figure out what a cat looks like, what a dog looks like. You run it through the program on these powerful chips. And you come back days later, weeks later, whatever, however complicated it is. And now your system can make predictions on new data. So you give it a picture of a dog that it's never seen before and say, hey, guess what this is? A dog or a cat? And if the system learned from the millions of examples, it could predict 99% of the time accurately, hey, that's a cat, that's a dog. Okay. So the adage that garbage in, garbage out, which sort of follows software development, is the same. Like if you don't code well, garbage in, then it doesn't come out, the garbage out. But that same principle applies to modern machine learning systems, but now it's data in, data out. So if the data going in is garbage, then the outputs are going to be garbage. And to take it one step further and also closer to your question, if the input data is biased, the output data is biased. So moving away from cats and dogs, for example, imagine, and this happened, there are these systems are out there and they're actually used, unfortunately, or to some people's dismay, quite widely, AI systems that law enforcement agencies across the country use to predict where crime is going to occur. So that would tell them, hey, this is great. Like now we have limited resources. The AI system is going to predict if you're thinking this is a lot like, Minority Report. Yes, it is. The system's going to predict where crime's going to occur, right? But remember, like cats and dogs, how is the AI system learning in the first place? It's learning from data. And if that data is police data from jurisdictions that have a history of discriminatory policing, for example, they don't, of course, I'm not suggesting that it's, they all do. I'm saying there are documented jurisdictions, let's say, where that was basically decided by courts that there was discriminatory policing. If that data becomes the training data of an AI system, and then of back to vendors, but not education vendors, but you have private vendors selling these systems to police departments, right? And then the police departments are using a system which is trained to go to, let's say, African American neighborhoods because that's where the quote unquote crime was occurring in the past. But the crime was happening maybe everywhere, probably everywhere, except that's where police officers were going to those neighborhoods in the past. And so the system's going to keep sending police officers there today. And so you have the situation where you could have like a laundering of bias from the past run through the computer and now project it into the future. And not only at the same level, but at scale, because these systems are now doing, if they're making 100,000 decisions, it's not a one-off. It's like it increases over time. So that's how, so you were asking about the back end after the model is trained, okay? And if you're talking about generative AI models, what's the training data for that? The training data for that is just think the internet. Think the internet and think of Google Books and think of everything that's out there. But when you think of the internet, think about 4chan, think about Twitter, think about Reddit. So the data that's going to these systems are going to reflect not humanity. They're going to reflect only the information that is on the internet, which doesn't represent, let's say, the global South and to your industry, languages. That's why the AI systems are so heavily focused on English languages, and Western culture, because that's what's on the internet. But if the system is not trained on foreign languages, it can't learn it. And so with the same with when it comes to what's on the internet that these systems are learning from? Well, there's Wikipedia. There's academic articles. That's all in the system. It's learning how the world works, or it's understanding how language works in all these fields. But it's also got a lot of garbage, and a lot of that garbage happens to be biased, and that's all in the system. So what happens is you run the model of hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe or not billions, but maybe we'll get there. Hundreds of millions of dollars, or $100 million, or $10 million, whatever it is. You train the model, and if you were just to release it as is, it would be a disaster,
Disaster, yeah.
right? So the reinforcement learning with human feedback comes before the release of the public, but after the initial training of the algorithm. And so, right, there's already bias in the system deeply, and what the after like sort of the that step that you're referring to is a way to minimize it, to improve not just on bias, but also the helpfulness, the capabilities. Like that's a good answer. I mean, that makes sense. It's grammatically correct. It's responsive to my prompt. So eliminating bias is part of that process, but it's also just to improve the quality of the outputs, right?
And yeah,
Yeah. So
sorry.
but then get to your point, the people that are helping to improve, they're not OpenAI. These are people, number one, that are getting paid maybe pennies per thumbs up, thumbs down click. Maybe they're getting paid $3, $4 an hour, and not even in America. This is coming from third world countries. So, like, when you talk about, when you hear people from big tech or the people that are developing these really powerful models and saying we're going to build them to align with human values, who's human values? Who's human values? Right. So, I think that gets at your point, which is that we cannot take the outputs like a calculator, like that. These are objectively correct without at least appreciating that there are human values baked into the model before you even prompt it. And then when you prompt it, the output is going to potentially reflect some of those biases. And it could be political biases. It doesn't have to be racial or ethnic. It could be political leanings, for example, right? So,
Yeah.
yeah.
It feels so complicated. My in the sense that it is, I know this isn't maybe the first iteration, although it feels like it, because we're all now using it. And I don't think we all really understand the complete wild, wild west of it all, of how it gets its information, and how much more fine-tuning needs to be done, because we are seeing things that ChatGPT can help us in our daily lives like we've never seen before. So I think people are so amazed, and I'm guilty of this, of amazed at some of the skills that it can do and the tasks that it can do for us, but we're not really, we kind of are ignoring a little bit about, where it's getting, how it gets its information, how it's correcting, how it's learning, where it's coming from. And I think this is kind of like, we spoke about this, I think, a few weeks ago. Number one, I think this is why you're kind of involved, where you're like, well, how is this all going to be regulated as we move forward? How do we improve? How do we make it unbiased? And everybody sort of, there has to be a checks and balances, like amongst everyone. I think you said something like that, right? Like everybody has is a stakeholder when it comes to this new technology, because of how it's affecting everyone. And so it can be the best tool for a human being. I don't know if that was a question, but does that, you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's it. That's exactly right. And it gets back to your earlier point. The interesting sort of social and economic and political dynamics is so complex because of interdependencies and historical trends about regulation and deregulation and things like that. But getting a little bit more directly to your point, the market will likely favor capabilities. You know, most people will not be exposed to sort of the ex or if they are, they won't even know it, to the types of bias things that I'm talking about, or they know it's possible, but you know what? They really want this generative AI to help do their homework or to help write a blog post or to send emails or whatever they're using it for. Very, very powerful tools and very, very useful tools. But the market, that's why if you leave it to the market doesn't always, the market says what the market wants, but that doesn't mean it's in the public's interest,
Right.
right? And so what's, you know, that is the difficult balance. And this is a really good opportunity for me to be very clear about something that I have not expressed well, is that these systems have extraordinarily positive potential, extraordinary in education, in government. You know, like it could be great. It could really improve the provision of welfare benefits. You know, it can make child protection safer. It can make law enforcement less biased. You know, it could be
Right.
used in so many important, and it is. It's being used in so many valuable ways. And I just want to be clear that nothing I'm saying here should be taken to be so hyper-focused on the negative that we're
Right.
losing sight of all the positive. But this is what I want to say. If all it was bad, it'd be a no-brainer. Like we would just it, we wouldn't allow it. You know, so it's like that is something. The fact that we're allowing it is just the way to say, like, that's why we're not just banning it. You know, that's
Yeah,
why we're
right.
talking about mitigating risk and regulating. It's because it is so potentially useful, both also geopolitically, strategically, militarily, like for so many reasons, that the idea that we're just not going to, we're going to just shut down AI despite some very serious and real concerns, is because of its such positive potential, right?
Yeah,
And
yeah.
so it's important to our for me to articulate that, at least.
Well, like, yeah, because it might be a good segue into this, because you're talking about like two things, like a double-edged sword, the positive and the negative of all this, and there's a lot of positive, and it's obviously here to stay. So we're gonna have to figure out the smart people of the world are going to have to figure out, you know, how do we make it safe? How do we make it ethical? But, you know, it's here to stay. I think it's going to be quite the roller coaster of a road as we continue. You know, you sent me this great article, and I want to bring it here. It was called "The Double-Edged Sword of AI in Education," by Rose Luckin from the Brookings Institution. And this is something that I'm actually I it's funny and also scary. You know, the article talks about cognitive atrophy through over-reliance on AI. And I obviously we all have this sort of experience now. I used to be a very good speller. I don't really have to, you know, it's that skill has definitely diminished. I notice it now. I don't even have to remember when you have to memorize directions. Like it used to be like a fun thing to do. Now we don't even have to do that. And I sort of feel like, okay, is my memory like, am I losing it? You know, like, and I think I am. So I'm just curious, you know, when it comes to education, and I know you have your children as well as your students, you know, I'm curious how you handle AI with your students and how educational institutions can use AI, you know, to boost learning while still preserving the students' natural cognitive abilities and critical thinking. That's the part that I feel like we can lose. And I'm also curious, you know, how do you, I know it's just not students and it's probably also your colleagues too. Like you guys probably professors and teachers, educators have such a challenge because it's not going away. You know your students are using it. How do you incorporate all that? How do your colleagues handle all of this, the benefits and the scariness of AI in a university?
I think it's people are taking it up at different speeds and taking it in different directions, both at the institutional administrative level, but also to the level of different professors in different classrooms. And one of my roles among my faculty is to keep them sort of alert to what's happening on the ground and also what I think is coming. And so I distinctly remember, you know, as I mentioned, ChatGPT dropped like November 30th, something like that, 2022, in December 2022, right before finals. And we're talking about academic integrity, like, you know, think proctoring, you know, all the normal stuff, nothing, not, and not about AI. And I said, guys, this is going to be the last time we have this conversation without talking about what just happened last week. Because I knew it as soon as ChatGPT came out, and it wasn't just me, obviously, but amongst my faculty, certainly, like nobody was tuned in. But it was immediately evident that this is going to just completely change how education, you know, if for no other reason, we got to think about take home essay assignments. You know, we have to think about legal research, legal writing, you know, fundamental skills. And for so putting aside issues of integrity, you know, which don't even exist really. Like, what is plagiarism, you know, in the context of an AI output, which we certainly had no concept for. We're using analogies. We're trying to use what we know from the past and apply it to something new. But the short of it, Josh, is that there was no instruction manual for educators or for anybody else in the world. And by the way, there really still isn't. Nobody asked for this. And all of a sudden, not, you know, you, like in the same way that, you know, people in your profession and in your industry have trained and built certain skills and aptitudes over the course of many, many years, all of a sudden, you got to maybe start over and like rethink everything. Like, this is like a bombshell. And so we are very much still in the process of, you know, getting up to speed as either as individuals or, you know, at the university level. And then again, as I said, different universities are proceeding at different speeds with different priorities and so on and so forth. But so this gets me into like one of the things that I talk about with my faculty, and one of the things that we will be expanding into the classrooms probably this semester is what they're calling AI literacy. Again, it's another catch term, but I have no problem with it. I think it captures an idea, which is that, look, we don't have to be experts in the technology because this is social. This is, we have to be experts in how this affects our day-to-day lives, our professions, our fields of study. And technology does not exist in a vacuum. It only exists in a social context. And so I certainly don't want the big technology companies determining how to teach. I don't want them dictating what the law is any more than I'm telling them how to do reinforcement learning with human feedback. Like, we can't sit this out. And this is, and I share this message with my students, my colleagues, with lawyers that I talk to, is that we cannot leave this to a group of individuals who have a very particular worldview and that are going to potentially be making decisions not only that are last for generations, but that could affect the world over. So everybody has to get involved, and lawyers have a place, and educators have a place. The people that are you make building platforms have a place. Student, everybody has a place. Our politicians have a place. And so this is where we're at right now, is because these are all new conversations, because when ChatGPT lands, and certainly in the wake of the social media, which we're still going through, we never figured that out. Our politicians and policymakers never got on top of that. And we never passed comprehensive federal privacy laws. California did, because the federal government did not. But having not resolved issues about social media platforms and about data privacy, and now having this land on top of it, these are aggregating factors. And so now you could generate AI images on platforms that are not regulated, basically. So, at scale, in ways that can be great, and creative, and democratizing, because now everybody could be a creator and share information and knowledge, and you could learn new languages and new skills. But also, the values that are baked into the system is one thing. We talked about that. But also, there are societal, more systemic, not just to the individual, but to society. And when you think about cars, or like, I don't know, engines, their purpose is to get you from A to B. They use fuel. The exhaust, the pollution that comes, the emissions, the carbon emissions, it's not the point of cars. It's a byproduct. The byproduct. And so the question is, who's going to absorb the cost of that byproduct? Is it on industry, or is society going to bear the cost of that byproduct? And so one way to think about AI technologies today is that companies want to internalize the profits, but there's these unintentional, it's not malintent, although it could be that too. I'm not talking about malintent. I'm talking about the intent is to create useful products, but the byproducts, the unintentional consequence, like the exhaust, the air pollution, could be a deterioration in critical thinking, in learning new languages, in the same way that you were saying, I don't know how to read a map anymore. And certainly my kids don't. And so this is how we have to think about it. This is why government is needed, because it's one of the things about markets. Markets are great for what they're great at, but the markets don't work when there's an information asymmetry, meaning that one side is all the information, and like if we don't know about the risks and only industry does, then market's not working, because the consumers can't make educated choices if we don't know what the risks are, right? So information asymmetry. And another is like these collect what's called like collective action problems, where it's in everybody's interest, like every OpenAI, every Google, every Microsoft, it's in all of their interest to make money and to improve the capabilities of these products. And if any one of them were to say, well, we got to put the brakes on and invest much more into some of these negative, unintentional externalities to society, then they could be eclipsed by their competitors. And so they need th what you know the, what the companies at least say they need. They want, nobody wants to stop or slow down unless everybody does. But everybody's not going to unless there's laws that require them to. So this is the relationship between markets and politics that we haven't really reached. We never really came to any kind of a consensus in the modern technology ecosystem, but like, again, social media, for example. And now we're confronting all the same problems in a context where these companies are even more powerful, they're even bigger, and AI raises national security and biosecurity threats. Like, it becomes a geopolitical, like a global pressures on top. So, in other words, and it gets back to my point about the government's reliance on industry. You hear a lot of talk about competition with China, both economically and militarily, and the role that AI will have in sort of elevating or changing the dynamics amongst world powers. Well, if the government depends on industry to maintain an advantage on the global stage, then the government has a difficulty to regulate the industry that doesn't want to be regulated because the government relies on the industry for the government's
Oh,
dominance
wow.
on the global stage, right? So there's so many layers to this, Josh, and it's why
Yeah.
it's just endlessly fascinating, but it's also why it's so important to get people educated. And so, like right now in California, I meant to mention earlier, getting back to my
Is that the
work.
AI? So when you talk about AI literacy, that is the concept of getting people educated and
Yes.
understanding,
Not even
bringing
that.
every.
Yeah, like I would say there's different levels. Like that could be AI literacy 400 level class. You know, like
Yeah.
AI literacy 101 is to understand that bias in, bias out, that
Yes.
these systems are made like they're very complex, what they're capable of, what they're not capable of, you know, the some of the unintentional negative consequences that you have to, you know, you risk as an individual losing your ability to think for yourself and independently. You might be nudged without even knowing subconsciously in a particular direction, in the same way that our pre-GPT algorithms on social media nudge us towards certain viewpoints and rabbit holes. That could happen and is happening with AI as well. So just AI literacy is really just the awareness of, like, you know, start small. The
Yeah.
bigger thing about like why this is hard to regulate and the geopolitical dynamics, I do get into that with my law students, but that's not the kind of thing that would have to be incorporated at AI literacy. And also, we need to be thinking about AI literacy from kindergarten up, you know. So, of course, you have to, in the same way that we teach everything from the kindergarten up, and you increase levels of complexity. It's funny because I mentioned, remember in 5th grade, you learned about the Constitution, then you learned about it again in 12th grade, and maybe you took a class in college, right? And
Yeah.
you're in law. Same thing with AI literacy. We got to start now. We got to start
Right.
now. And then you build on that. And we are starting now. But we were so far behind because, first of all, on the heels of COVID, the you know, teachers are already burnt out, you know, like they're barely holding on.
Yeah.
There's already a re over reliance on technology as a crutch, you know, because we had to, you know. And then all of a sudden, ChatGPT comes along without instructions, and individual teachers are or not figuring it out, and then teaching our kids or they're not about all the things we're talking about. And
Yeah.
so there is an increasing awareness of the need to get this going, but it's only just going, Josh. I would say it's the exception. If when schools are doing this kind of thing, and it's at a very small level, and as you like expand out and get into higher education, we would be only beginning to see more of it, but it's still in its infancy. So there's like tons of number one opportunities here, and also, but there's also a lot of room for responsibility and for people to step up and be leaders and to be a voice of you know, an educator. To bring people in the same way like we're doing now, Josh, it's bringing people into and being more aware of just what's
Yeah.
going on without making any decisions about what to do. Just understand what's going on is a really
Yeah.
important first step.
And do you see laws coming into play where we are slowing the progress down? Like that's I feel like that's a train that's hard to
Yeah.
stop.
Well, this is why it's interesting, Josh, and I'm glad we could almost like circle back as we maybe wind down a little bit. In California today, like this week, last week, California's, you'll find the headlines if you just type in SB 1047. California, like they were the vanguard, the forefront of privacy, data privacy legislation. It's a huge state, as you know, and it's a huge market. And like the federal government can kind of influence the market because of its purchasing power. Well, California is one of the biggest markets in the world. And so if California has rules about, hey, you have to audit your systems, companies, if they want to do business in California, you're going to have to oblige. And once they've already audited their systems, well, everybody benefits from that, you know, because the companies aren't, well, they might, they could have systems that are audited and not, but probably all else equal, the companies want to have safe systems, right? So if they've gone through the trouble of auditing them and making sure they're safe, chances are we'd all benefit. So California is taking, you know, at the forefront of some of these efforts, and this bill, SB 1047, it is specifically targeted at only the most capable. Even in fact, it applies to absolutely zero AI systems, absolutely zero companies today that we know about. This regulation is for the next generation of AI systems. Like, think about your GPT-5, GPT-6 kind of thing, your Llama 4s. That exceed a certain amount of compute power to train, a very high level, bigger than GPT-4, that costs $100 million or more to train, and that would potentially cause catastrophic harm inside California, $500 million, mass casualties, and in order to help prevent against that, Senator Weiner of California has sort of advanced this bill, and it's actually got a good chance of clearing the legislature. We'll see what the governor does. But the tech companies, all of whom, and this gets us to ourselves, right, all of them have said voluntarily, yes, we're going to work with the White House and the national government, and we're going to make sure that our systems are safe and secure, all voluntary. But as soon as there's actually a law that could pass, which is, by the way, this gets me back to federalism, the Congress is not passing a law. Like, they can't do anything. Not anytime soon, but California can, smaller states can, politics are different. And what that does is it forces positions. Now you have the same companies that, like, literally were testifying to Congress about this could lead to bio hazards and nuclear threats and all this stuff. The very same companies are lobbying very hard, very, very intently in California. And again, I'm not saying that who's right or wrong. I'm just saying it's happening. And they're really pushing back. They probably will succeed, Frank. We'll see. We're going to know in a few weeks. But they're insisting that they not be regulated. And so, like, this is the thing. When it's just the federal government, it's like you could go and before the Congress and committee and say, yeah, we should regulate. It's dangerous, knowing that it's never going to happen. But this is why the fact that we have multiple layers of government, the fact that Congress can't, does not mean that California can't. And it's only because California is not talking about it, but they actually might do it. They actually might pass a law like this that it forces the industry to take a position. Look, are you actually doing safety testing? Because if you are, then why do you care if you're regulated? The law does not make you do anything other than you basically said you were already going to do. Right. And the fact that they're pushing back is a reason for concern. Like, well, maybe they're saying they're doing these things, but they're not, because, like, you know, and so again, there's a lot of issues with the SB 1047. I'm not here to debate the merits or demerits. I'm just saying it's a very interesting case study of the dynamics, the market dynamics with these big companies, our future government regulation. And it's happening in your backyard. I mean, it is happening in
That's
California
crazy.
today.
And if I bring it back to education and like to maybe having to regulate ourselves, there was an article in the Atlantic that was called "The End of Foreign Language Education." Now, if I go back to the whole spelling and how you lose that skill, and it's almost like there is a skill that that learning a new language as a human being, it's really good for you. It's good for your brain and memory and all that. But I it's like I, here's my question. It's how should educational institutions adapt to ensure that AI serves to complement rather than replace human learning, particularly in areas as vital as language education? And that's my question that I might to follow up on that is also, I don't think you can stop it though. Like I feel like people, it will be easier. There'll be maybe a chip in our head at some point where somebody speaks another language and you just interpret it in your language. And it's like you're gonna have to have the willpower to know that, okay, learning a language a natural way is really good for me. So I'm going to do that. I'm gonna take French and learn it like a natural way and not cheat with AI. Is that something, do you see that as something that we're really going to have to, be in control of and like make ourselves want to do that. Just in the way that we have to slow down some of this stuff because it's too fast and we can't, as human beings, keep up with it.
Yeah. You asked about my students and you asked about my kids. And so this is a nice way to bring them into, my kids are, they're older. I mean, they're, one is, in college, going to be a sophomore. The other one's a senior in high school. So these are at an age where you could have, AI literacy type conversations. And we do, they don't listen. They don't listen, of course. They roll their eyes, because they're normal kids. But I still talk to them about it. Like I talk to them about drugs and social media and sex. You talk to them about AI because it matters. It's not clear at all to me how to advise them what to major in and what to do because nobody knows what the future holds. Nobody knows. If you asked me 3 years ago, I said, "Do be a coder. Go to computer science. That might be one of the first jobs to go." Because the AI systems can now code. It's not that there's not going to be any coders, don't get me wrong, but there's less of a need for them. It's going to be harder to find jobs because you'll be able to use these systems to create code, to actually create apps and all kinds of things. And so there's, again, there will be work and they'll certainly at the higher levels, but there'll also be less work and less need. And so I don't know what to advise my kids about, like even things like STEM. I don't want to, again, I don't want to go on a limb here because I don't know. I'm not a future teller either, but I could just tell you what I think, what I tell my kids, and people can do what they want with it. I think that soft skills, the kind of things that were maybe poo-pooed in the past become more valuable in the future where AI is taking over some of the more mathy stuff. But where's the empathy? Where's the human connection? Where's the communication, the person-to-person communication? I see that, like, you need to be, I tell my kids, like, number one, we need to be flexible, number one, because our kids are going to have to change careers. I've seen like maybe seven times, not just jobs, careers. So this building resilience, and by the way, COVID was great. God, it's terrible, but it, one of the people that got through it became more resilient, especially the kids, because it was not easy for anybody. And but resilience is so important. And the irony is that AI is breaking down resilient in the same way that, let's say, I don't know, TikTok, Instagram, like my kids can't focus for anything for a little more than a minute, right? Because they've just been inundated to be thinking in 1 minute video clips, and what I keep trying to remind them about is that you need to build resilience and be in the face of adversity to be able to change jobs, change careers. So find something you love to do. That's my advice. Don't try to game the system. If you try to guess what's going to be there or not, I could only say at a very high level of generality, what types of skills are just the human skills. Like what makes us uniquely human is a moving goalpost. Josh, you and I talked about this, as you said, a few years ago. It's like, well, they're not creative. These systems are not creative. Do you think so? I mean, it depends on how, then it becomes how you define creativity, right? It's not about anything other than definitions. And we just keep moving. What do we mean by judgment? What do we mean by wisdom? What do we mean by creativity? And even like they're not that, these systems are not that funny. We like, are these things funny? No, they're not. But they also were terrible at doing art 16 months ago. It's great if you ever want to, 5 minutes to spare, just go online and see what the images look like a year ago, like from DALL-E and Midjourney, and just compare them from literally a year ago. It's like, whoa. And then video, of course, but everything's just going to keep getting better and better. So don't think because whatever AI could do today is the worst AI we're going to see. Because they're just, and it's not just in 10 years. I mean, like every month, every 2 months, it's something new, And so it's just moving so fast. So to try to, if you think about, a hockey puck, you got to skate in front of it. Like this is like hyper fast. And you'd have to skate so far ahead of it that it's just guesswork at that point. And so find something you love to do. Because then you could find happiness regardless. And be resilient and be well-rounded so that you can pivot and do different things. And so that's what I tell my kids.
Yeah, and it's like if you want to learn a language, you learn a language. That's
Right.
gonna,
Well,
you'll
to
learn the
your point,
culture.
yes. Yes, to your point, Josh, exactly. It's like you, in the same way that you could tell kids, like, look, you're cheating yourself. We've been saying this for a decade. Oh, yeah, probably from the beginning of time. You're cheating yourself.
Just a new
And
medium.
so I don't know, does that who does that message land with? And where does it fail? And but we have there's so many again complexities. It's like number one, if we don't need to know how to read a map anymore, then what's the loss? Right? Because like maybe that's just a lost skill. We don't have to know things that a calculator could do, maybe, right? But what about the things that we do need to do that we want or that we want humans to be able to continue to do? And here, getting to your point about languages and things like, and just communication and writing. And again, now we get into like more like cognitive science and even, you know, things like that. But there's a lot of science saying like the act of reading, the act of communicating, the act of writing, not the product, the act of learning a new language is a fundamental cognitive development that you could lose. So it's not just that you don't learn a language, it's that you don't develop your mind in ways that would work in for everything you do in your life. And so it's hard because these are like very abstract concerns versus the very tangible, I got to get my homework in. I got to write this essay. Then people will just choose the easy way out. And again, it's the same way. It's incentives and long range, you know, abstract things don't land like more immediate, more tangible things. And so if we don't, and this gets to AI literacy, this is why we at least have to talk to our students or at least talk to our kids. And we have to, and not just that, educate our policymakers so that at least we can make choices about these things. You know, you can't make the kids believe you that they're hurting themselves, but at least tell them, you know, so that they can make the choice and do what we can as professors to inspire them to want to learn, to read, to be critical thinkers. And in the law field, like, you know, every industry has their things, you know, that are just fundamental, at least until now, to the work and critical thinking. I mean, if there's one thing we pride ourselves, at least we try to pride ourselves, most law schools and university, we're not, yes, we teach the law because they got to learn the law, but we teach them how to think like lawyers because the law changes, the skills. And so a concern, at least in legal education, like legal writing is a huge skill, is that the student, like we want to, on the one hand, and I do, I in my, because I teach an AI class, you know, but I'm the only one. I teach my students how to be good at using ChatGPT, like because their employers are going to want them to be, you know, but at the same time, you have to have their own buy-in that they cannot lose the ability to think critically, right? And so that is the difficult sell, but the way to sell it is to get this, not to tell it. It's to have the student internalize it. And that's what educators do, right? You have to inspire. And that's our only defense.
David, thank you. I guess we can cut it here, but like I know how busy you are. I thank you for sharing your wisdom on all this AI education, the law. I can see why you'd be a great professor, Mr. Rubenstein, because you take these complex topics and you make them genuinely interesting. And I think we all learned a lot today, and it's always a pleasure having these conversations with you. And I'm grateful you were my first guest and
I
allowed us
know.
to pick your big brain.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Josh. You're a dear, dear friend of mine. I think the world of you, and I'm just so happy to. This is fun. I appreciate it.
This was so fun. So to our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. We'll be coming out with another episode pretty soon. Our next guest on the e-learning lounge is Dr. Janine DeFalco. She's an expert in training and AI, and she's doing some incredible work on how technology can transform education in innovative and impactful ways. She's trained the Navy. It's going to be a great conversation, I think, full of insight. So please be sure to tune in. A quick shameful plug, if anyone needs help making their e-learning content accessible worldwide, PGLS specializes in translating and localizing e-learning content for any industry. Please feel free to reach out to me at jsternlicht@pgls.com. David, again, thank you so much for being here. Hopefully I get to see you in person soon. To everyone out there, I'm Josh Sternlicht. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time on the eLearning Lounge.